Richard Sembrook is director of global news at the BBC. In 1980, he started his journalistic career as a sub-editor producing radio. I don't know what a sub-editor is, but it sounds like the beginning of a long climb to where you are today. Along the way, he has covered and produced things on things like the fall of the Berlin Wall, three US presidential elections, pretty much every part of the world. He has covered the Far East, the Middle East, the United States, Europe, and so forth. He has, bless you, grabbed the excitement of the digital era like nobody as a senior executive in media has, that bringing together the continued highest standards of journalism with the enthusiasm of a blogger, which he is, and in fact a Twitterer who is now doing less blogging because he's doing so much Twittering, but in the process leading the BBC to become truly, I think, a model for experimentation in this space. He doesn't have all the answers, but I suspect he's got some pretty good questions for us. Richard Sembrook, thank you for making the long trip.
RSS feeds that I regularly read to find out what's going on in this area are sitting here in the room, so I'm not quite sure what it is I'm going to be able to add, but we'll find out as we go through.
Who here has ever been reduced to an RSS
feed? It's really nice to put faces to them, though. I can just say that. I'm going to try and do two or three things, very much from the perspective of an old media guy. I've been nearly 30 years in the BBC, but one who's sort of obsessed with the future. And who's grappling with trying to take a kind of big and complicated organisation into that future one way or another. So I'm just going to try and do three things as a provocation, take stock a little bit of where we are and what's happening and how it's happening, and maybe a bit of a reality check on one or two things. Point out one or two new strands that are kind of breaking all around us, and I think everyone here will be aware of them, but just to talk a little bit about that, and maybe just pose some questions we might think about over the next 24 hours or so. So... Okay, that's Jay Rosen. There we are. So 3 years ago at the Blogging, Journalism and Credibility Conference, Jay said that blogging versus journalism is over, proving that even if everything else is changing under our feet, the power of a good soundbite endures. It really works. And all power to him. They're very important. Blogging versus journalism is over, and the forces of denial are in retreat. So what's happened since then? Well, you know, reading the notes of that meeting again, as I did last week, it's remarkable what a different world that was. Just 3 years ago, there were major broadcasters there who didn't really understand what a podcast was. There were major media people who just had no idea really how to relate to blogs or what they should be for them. A lot has happened, and I guess not least, one of the big things that's happened is that convergence has actually arrived. We've talked about convergence in the media, in the news media in particular, for a long time, but it's absolutely happening now all around us. Social networking has definitely exploded in the last 3 years. Facebook and MySpace and Twitter and so on have definitely taken off. And I think, looking back, the other big thing that we'll get on and talk about is that the web has become live and dynamic. And 3 years ago, it was still, you know, pretty much text-based and pretty much a kind of notice board. And now it's very much about video, and it's very much alive, and it's very much a conversation. So things have moved a long way, I think. There are still issues of trust and credibility. There's still issues of transparency and accountability that we're grappling with. And we still get very caught up on this question of opinion versus objectivity, which I'm not going to get sidetracked down, but I will touch on a little bit. But we still also enjoy debating blogging versus journalism. I liked Arianna Huffington, who said that bloggers suffer from compulsive obsessive disorder and journalists suffer from attention deficit disorder. And I think that's pretty much true. As a friend of mine, Kevin Anderson, who now works for The Guardian, used to work for the BBC, said that news stories should answer questions and blog posts should ask questions and encourage debates. Quite an interesting way of looking at it. But anyway, we know that they're really different things, at least. And certainly the phase of denial is over. The future of news is online. I think very few major news organizations now would argue that actually they have to have an online presence, and actually the future of news and information is moving online very rapidly. The BBC has over 100 podcasts available. I listen to NPR regularly sitting in London. Washington Post has 76 blogs. I think that's quite remarkable, really. And some of them also have links and interact with other sites as well. I'll come on to that. The New York Times there is getting into video. The Guardian, again, in London last month won a TV journalism award, which seems to me was quite a remarkable moment, really. But I do think there are big questions. These really are not about participation or collaboration. They're not really outward-looking. There are very few links, and I'm critical of the BBC here as well. We have a lot of blogs, very few links going out, very little interactivity with the comments. And a part of that is something about the DNA of big media, which is still absolutely hardwired to the one-to-many model. And it's fantastically difficult to break that. And indeed, there's quite a big question about whether you should even try. But some of the things that, you know, were predicted over the last few years are definitely happening. The Project for Excellence in Journalism, State of the News Media 2008 report came out just a week or so ago and talked about news shifting from a product to a service, and that news sites are no longer seen as final destinations. And I think both of those things are absolutely true, and things that were being talked about three or four years ago, but now are absolutely happening. And of course, we have a whole lot of new news sites. OMI News is one of the obvious ones, Now Public, News Trust Net. Memorandum, I think, is quite an interesting one as well. Interesting uses of technology. A lot of this is citizen journalism, but interesting use of technology as well. An algorithm replacing a newsroom. Can an algorithm really do the work of dozens of journalists? It seems in some cases it can. Google News as well, of course, does that. And Google is now, I think, the fourth most trusted news brand in the world, and it doesn't create any content at all. So these sites, I think, are a great source of creativity and innovation, really interesting use of technology, but they're not yet moving into the mainstream. And I think that's something we can talk a little bit about later on. For the big players, we talk a lot about citizen journalism and user-generated content. These are stills from Tibet, usually sent in by mobile phone. That last one there is a CNN poster in Mumbai. So big media talks about citizen journalism a lot, and it's become a marketing tool. You know, you have to be talking about citizen journalism. You have to be seen and talking about being open to contributions from your public. But I think it's very narrowly defined. I mean, broadly, I think of kind of four categories of citizen journalism. There's what I call, I suppose, eyewitness news, which is the Tibet stuff and Burma and so on is an example of people sending their photographs, sending their video, emailing eyewitness reports. Now, the media's always had that. We've always interviewed eyewitnesses. We've always used material that's been available from eyewitnesses. But, of course, the technology now means it's available on a far greater scale. It still raises issues. There were very hard limits to what could be done in Burma, for example, when they simply controlled the internet and turned it off, and some, obviously, evidence of that as well in Tibet. There are very hard limits to this, so people who are going to say citizen journalism is going to do away with the need for professional journalism and media and so on, that's not true. I actually think they're complementary. But that's only one category of citizen journalism. There's the sharing of opinion, and I guess the obvious example of that is blogs. And actually, I think mainstream media has not been very good at assimilating that in, although we ought to be, because there's nothing new about it. The telephone phone-in program, the format for radio, has been there for decades. And actually, assimilating blog comment into mainstream news coverage is really no different from a phone-in as a principle, as an editorial principle, and we could do it a lot more easily and in a rather kind of richer and more valuable way, I think. So there's a sharing of experience, if you like, the sharing of opinion, the sharing of discovery, news breaks on the net. I've got a couple of examples of that in a moment, and that's, you know, reportable in any other way. And then we get to the kind of sharing of expertise, and I guess that's what people call networked journalism. And I certainly want to talk about that. And I think, in a way, that is probably the more valuable and the kind of richer example of what citizen journalism holds out, but the most difficult to deliver. And there are people in this room who've been absolutely at the forefront of trying to develop networked journalism and understand what it's about. From my position, I'll give you a couple of examples. Again, I think it's really difficult for mainstream media to really do that. However, the point I really want to make is that actually this kind of participation is still a minority sport. It's absolutely a minority of our audiences who engage in it. It's not to say that there's no value. A lot of people are reading it and appreciating it who don't actually contribute, but it is still a minority sport. Let me give you one example from the BBC. At the end of last year, we chartered a boat and took it up right through Bangladesh, and particularly through the areas that are going to disappear. It's predicted within 20 to 30 years if the predictions of global warming and climate change come true. We held a number of debates there. But we also tried to take that coverage out through social media to new audiences and different audiences you might not normally engage with that issue. So we had a Google Map on the site, and we took it out through Flickr and Twitter and other things as well. But you look there, we had 26 followers on Twitter. That's not a lot of impact, to be honest with you. Actually, Flickr was rather better. It was about 50,000. So there's a question from my position about the innovation of this, which is definitely the right thing to do. This is just a learning curve, and there are all sorts of reasons why, you know, we may not have picked up the right story, presented it in the right way, found the right audience. Is the audience that's really interested, it got access to the technology. There's all sorts of complicated issues behind that. But in the end, we had several million people who tuned in and listened to it on shortwave radio, and we had 26 people on Twitter. Here's a little bit of video about it. We got any sound?
Websites, and we did this in three different ways. The first one was through using Google Maps, which allowed the users to follow our journey every single step of the way. The second was through Flickr, which allowed us to share all the photos that all of our journalists were taking. Things like a man sat on a giant 2-meter block of fish. We had a child driving a herd of emaciated cattle across a river, and we were able to tell those stories. And the third of these was Twitter, which was a wonderful blogging tool which allowed us to keep our users updated to exactly where we were, even when we couldn't get online ourselves.
So that's an example. We broadcast that material in 17 languages, TV, on radio, and on the net, and so on as well. But it's not really about technology, I think, is the point that I'm trying to make here. A few weeks ago, I met a woman from Namibian radio, and we were involved again in a debate or discussion about participation and collaboration. And she says, well, in Namibia, it's about the telephone and the radio, and people use the radio as a telephone. And I said, well, what does that mean? And they said, well, the most popular program on Namibian radio are the death notices. And it's a very cultural thing. People ring in, they want to announce who's died, because then there's funeral. The funeral has a huge cultural significance as well as a kind of personal family significance. It's where you meet, you know, a wider group of people. It's where you, you know, discuss what's happening. It's discuss the crops. It's discuss that you get a new job. You meet the right people. It's a whole networking opportunity. The death notices are how, you know, have this huge place in the cultural place in society there. And also people use the radio. They'll phone in and say, leave a message. Can, you know, so-and-so meet me under the tree at the market. And even if they're not listening, somebody who knows them will and say, oh, by the way, you've got to meet on the market at 11 o'clock. It has huge social purpose and a place in society, in Namibian society, in that way. And it's old technology, but it's collaboration and it's participation, and it's very, very powerful. So it's not about the technology. And I think one of the questions for me, therefore, it is, you know, in Namibia, the telephone and the radio has a huge sense of social purpose, and it really works and is very powerful. I haven't really kind of conveyed it adequately enough. But what's the social purpose behind social networking, and, you know, have we really found one? And can we rediscover one and reconnect the importance of journalism with a social purpose through social media? And that's a very much an open question for me at the moment. See if I can get on past this. Yeah, there we are. So that's a classic long tail chart. The point I want to make here, it's taken from a European broadcaster's report looking at mass media on the internet. And what it shows is that the 5% of measurable internet sites in Europe, that's about 750 sites, account for the same number of users as the other 95%. So it's a classic long tail story. The top 10 sites there, as I understand it, I think the top 10 sites in the world, somebody might be able to correct me on this, control close to 1 billion users. And those top 10 include Google, Yahoo, Microsoft, Time Warner, Fox, big corporate media. It also includes Wikipedia, eBay and Amazon, I think, who you might have a discussion about. But my point here, again, is picking up off that Bangladesh boat thing. It's a reality check. Corporate media still has this huge grip on the internet and on a billion users and on the experience of the internet. And so even when enthusiasts such as myself get excited about the potential of social media, I think you have to remember most people experience information through traditional means, and corporate media still has a huge grip on it. And I think we need to really think about that when we talk about particularly some of the issues that Ernie raised, for example, those four categories, the issues around democracy. Is anything really going to change with that kind of corporate grip on access? That's not to deny that we're going through an absolutely tumultuous change. Something very transformational for particularly the news media is underway. in technology, in the economics of the business, in consumption. I want to use the music industry as an analogy here. I met the head of Sony BMG in the US, Rob Stringer. He's actually a Brit. And he told me a couple of weeks ago, in the music industry, it used to be a very simple model just 10 years ago. If you were trying to sell a single, you're trying to sell a song, you got radio airplay, you then got them on MTV, and you then shipped the discs to the record shops, and you made a lot of money. And that's what it was. Three stages, very simple business 10 years ago. Those three stages have now fragmented into 25 stages. It's about ringtones, it's about the timing of the download against the radio play, it's about the advertising tie-in. He said for every single song that they want to market, there are now 25 things that they have to work through. And he said you just have to accept that's what's happened. What was a three-stage process has become a kind of holistic 25-stage process. Well, I think something similar is happening to journalism and to information. It's fragmenting. The way that what was a simple process in one sense, the old model, we were selling readers to advertisers in newspapers. We had organisations with the resources to send reporters to go and find out what was happening, a production unit that packaged it up and you distributed it on paper or over the airwaves or however it was. It was, in the end, a simple one about access to resource and being able to sell eyeballs to advertisers. Now, that's fragmenting, and the role of the media now, it's not as simple as that at all, and it's about aggregation, facilitation, navigation, validation of what's out there, investigation, leadership of public debate, I hope. It's about where you can bring resources to bear. It's about explanation. It's about all sorts of things, but expressed in a very different way across this new landscape. And I think the example of what's happening in the music industry may provide some lessons for us in terms of what's happening to news and to information. And of course, that raises the big issue of the economics of the business. On the left here, we have Alan Rusbridger, who's the editor of The Guardian, and on the right, Bill Keller from The New York Times. And The Guardian, I think, Neil in the audience here, but I think they are doing something quite extraordinary. Really, it's a build it and they will come strategy. And Alan's been very open about that. He said, you know, we're going to invest very heavily in digital media in the hope that in 10 years the economics has changed and it's going to pay off. And The Guardian is transforming itself from a publisher and from a newspaper into a digital content platform, basically, and a global one as well. Now, that's a very ambitious strategy, but it is one that's based on a leap of faith. And it's a build it and they will come strategy. On the right, Bill Keller came to London at the end of last year to give a lecture, and he said he was optimistic about the future for two reasons. He said that actually quality journalism was a diminishing resource, but the demand has never been greater. And I questioned him on what he meant by that. And the diminishing resource was that more and more people are having to close their bureaus and pull out of it on a cost basis. But I said, what's the evidence for the demand has never been greater? And he said it's 17 million unique users to MIT.com, 50% from search, 50% direct. The problem, of course, is that 17 million users don't contribute to the cost base. MIT.com is profitable. I gather it makes something like $100 million profit a year. But the cost base of New York Times editorial operation is five times that. So again, there is a big hole there, and the only way of going forward, publisher of the New York Times kind of said, I think a year or so ago, he doesn't know whether they'll have a print edition in 5 years' time, and he doesn't care as long as the journalism survives, which is a great attitude to have, but there's a huge leap of faith of whether they can leap across that black hole in terms of the economics. Again, the State of the News Media Report, which is a great read if you haven't looked at it, had a quote, should newspapers drop their expectations for profitability to roll more money into developing their digital product, or will that money be wasted, failing to translate into enough readers to justify the cost? So that is really the huge question, particularly in newspaper publishing, and I think there's similar questions in other forms of commercial media. Online advertising is slowing, particularly on newspaper sites. Video advertising online is growing exponentially, but from a very low base. So the dynamics of the economics of this are simply not understood. It's not clear how it's going to end up, and there's a very big question about how you fund serious journalism going forward. And I'm sure that, again, is going to come up tomorrow. I talked a little bit about network journalism before. I just want to give a couple of examples of things that we've tried to do in the BBC. Like many others, we're experimenting. But I do think it's culturally, within the organisation, very important to try and reach out in that way. And in a sense, even if the usage is low, I think the cultural impact of trying to develop network journalism is huge. The PM programme in Great Britain is a radio drive time radio news programme. It's quite successful. And they've developed an interactive format for it. As the editor says, the more people share, the more we know, the better the relationship we have, and the more likely we are to find out about stories that punch through to the mainstream. Our ability to publish our rough notes, early draft running orders, and unedited interviews on the blog destroys the notion that we have a fixed agenda or a part of a secret club that exists to self-serve. So it's very open, it's inviting people to contribute, it's inviting ideas, it's inviting comment. A couple of examples. Two stories they've picked up from blogs. The last of the Iraqis blog, they picked up a story about a shift of power in one region of Iraq, I think ahead of other people. Spy blog is a UK site, Watching Them, Watching Us is the tag, so rather an interesting one. And he picked up a story about the use of cell phones in jails in the UK, and obviously you're not supposed to have cell phones if you're a prisoner and, you know, running drugs and all the rest of it, but there was a lot of it going on. Basically, it's just about being open. But of course, picking up stories from blogs and punching them through to the mainstream isn't really about network journalism. Network journalism, for me, is about how you use your audience to develop your agenda and to develop what you're doing. And that's incredibly difficult to do in radio and in television. It's quite difficult to do even online. But I think it's very important that we continue to look for ways to be outwardly focused and as open as we can be. Newsnight is an evening news programme on BBC television, and again they have what they do a daily call now, come to the morning meeting with ideas on how we do these or any other stories. They put their morning news list up online. This is what we're thinking of doing, these are the angles we're thinking of taking. Please comment, tell us what you want us to do, give us ideas. It's not a huge uptake, but for a Newsnight audience, which is a kind of niche audience, you know, it's very powerful, and they do get responsive, and they have picked stories up, and they have changed tack according to things, comments that have been made. And, you know, to some extent, they are able to tap into the expertise of the audience. They're on Facebook as well. There's a kind of Facebook group there, and, you know, again, I don't want to overstate it, because it's actually, in some sense, it's quite small, but culturally, the significance of the programme, opening up and being available like that, if you choose to engage with it, I think it's very significant. But it is unusual. I mean, we weren't the first. CBS did the same thing with their Public Eye blog after the Dan Rather episode. When they launched it, they said Public Eye is a fundamental mission to bring transparency to the editorial operations of CBS News, transparency that's unprecedented for broadcast and online journalism. And it closed in December after 28 months because CBS said no sustainable business model for it could be found. The notion that you have to have a business model for accountability is an interesting one for me, but there we are. However, the point I'm making is it's very easy to talk the talk. It's a lot harder to walk the walk, particularly in well-established media. Just starting to look for the future. So we know that, as I said earlier, the web is going video and going live. So we have things like seismic, video blogging. It's kind of Twitter in video, basically. You can see Loic Lemure telling you three or four times a day how great his life is. It's fantastic. Yahoo Live is a very similar thing. Quick, I'm sure some of you here know, you can stream live from a mobile phone. You can broadcast effectively live from your mobile phone. There's VPod TV, something rather similar. I'm afraid I'm not technologically smart enough to offer live video up on this, but not to worry. YouTube, I read, is about to go live. Blogging's gone video, live streaming from phones. I suppose the question it raises for me, this is at a very early stage, I acknowledge, but what's the content? Most of the content here on these sites so far is people talking into their webcams at their desk, or on Quick, it's live coverage of them taking the dog for a walk. What I really, and I don't want to disparage it, because I do think this is a really significant breakthrough, but very inward looking. And I think it's really essential that we break out of that. We've got to stop looking in the mirror and start looking out of the window. And I don't want to be overcritical, because this is at the very early stages of a very cutting-edge technology, and therefore it's bound to be, you know, in a little bit of a bubble. But I would put that challenge out, that I really think the opportunities here for news gathering and for extending our news gathering in a period where expensive foreign bureaus are being closed all the time is a huge opportunity that I don't think is yet really being fully grasped. Jeff Jarvis did a post about this recently, where he was absolutely evangelising again about this and saying it's fantastic if somebody, you know, managed to get that Obama speech on the mobile phone streamed up here, he could find it if only he knew who had done it and where to find it. And what we really needed was some fantastic kind of search and navigation in order to be able to find these kind of participatory streams. which is right. And then I thought, isn't that what news organisations do? If you want to watch the Obama speech live, switch on MSNBC. I mean, maybe they didn't cover it, I don't know. But there's a little bit of circularity here. It reminded me in the BBC of a conversation we had a few years ago about digital radio. Where the head of radio would say it's fantastic that you know, if we put it onto a digital signal, we can do all these new networks, these new channels, these new things with it. And what's more, we're going to be able to use pictures and show pictures as well. To which there was a long pause, and someone said, "Isn't that television?" So you've just got to be a little bit careful, I think, with some of these things that we don't reinvent the wheel. Interesting statistic: McKinsey say by 2010, 75% of digital content everywhere will be user generated because of this kind of development. In 2006, digital content accounted for 1,000 terabytes, and by 2010, 4 years later, it's anticipated to be 6,000 terabytes. So we've got exponential growth of this kind of content, but the question is, you know, what is the content? Because it's the content that matters. I suppose the one thing that this is, to try and draw out the bigger picture, this is the move from mass to community-based participation. And if you like, broadcasters were about, you know, mass communication. This is about communication within a community. You're part of the Seismic community or the VPod TV community. And I think that has very big implications going forward, which I'll try and touch on at the end. One of the things the technology is doing is bringing in what we call the new creatives, which are the real challenge, I think, to some of the big players. Because these are the startups that are more open, more flexible, fraction of the cost base, very innovative, heavily marketed, very, very smart marketing. A lot of them around personalised video experience. And I'm just going to talk through some of them that I've been struck with. Next New Networks says it's a new kind of media company creating micro-television networks over the internet for targeted communities, bringing together elements of TV programming and internet philosophy to allow viewers to contribute, share and distribute content. They have 101 networks, 50% of it is UGC. Have You Got the Nerve is a really interesting one. It's basically an independent production company that wants the commission from the public. So they say people are creative, but they don't have the opportunity to release that creativity. Whilst daydreaming at home or work, people come up with the most amazing ideas. Come up to them and they'll get it on mainstream TV. So it's kind of collaborative commissioning, I suppose, if you like. Quite an interesting one, British one. VidShadow, our mission is to create a central marketplace of video content where the user, a marketer, build and direct their own media experience on their own videos. In other words, circumventing the broadcasters. There's a lot more out there. Mogulus.com, Blog TV, you bring the webcam, they bring the stage, Ustream.com, Flixwagon. There's a real explosion of these things now. And as I said, I think the new creatives, the point about it is the cost base is probably less than a quarter of traditional broadcasting. And if they can build the right community, they can make a really viable business there. And I think it's a creative challenge, certainly to most of us in broadcasting. I'm not going to say much about this except to say the world's getting complicated. When I went into journalism, there was a British foreign correspondent called Nick Tomlin who wrote a book that said all you needed to succeed in journalism was a presentable manner, a little literary ability and rat-like cunning. Those three things will still get you quite a long way, but in future you're going to need some of this as well, I think. But let me pass on quickly. I want to just end with the thought about what's happening to the data-driven web. I talk a little bit about Web3 and the semantic web, and people roll their eyes because there's been talk about it for a long time. It's been a long time coming. I think it is about to break, and I think it's going to change things and take it up, ramp it up yet another level. This is a dummy page from the BBC, and you were talking earlier about the importance of democracy and what the role of social and digital media here is. If you go across the BBC websites, from local sites to national to international, to the news site, there's all sorts of different material available. There's coverage, there's constituency profiles, there'll be coverage of issues relevant to your locality, but you have to go all over the place to find it. So we're starting to put in place things for aggregation where you can have your own political dashboard. So you can pull in from across many of the BBC areas and mix it to your taste. What are you interested in? How are you interested in it? What are the issues you want to be reminded on and kept up to date with? What's happening in your constituency, in your area, mix it together into your own dashboard. If I was sitting out there where you are, I'd say, is it only BBC content? Why don't you open it up to other content? Well, we'll take it one stage at a time. We're an old-fashioned media company. We like our brand. But the fact that we can do that because of tagging and because of the way that this kind of data-driven web is developing is, I think, going to open up all sorts of opportunities for sites and collaboration and interactivity that we haven't yet seen. Another example, maybe. If I go back to the music analogy again briefly, one of the big changes over the last few years has been the shift in emphasis from the artist to the DJ, if you like, from the producer to the curator. And you go to a particular DJ because they've got a taste you like and they're going to bring you music that you wouldn't know, find out about otherwise. What's the equivalent for that in the information ecology? When I first started to kind of engage with the internet 15, 16 years ago, I had CompuServe and a 9.6 dial-up connection, and I used to have to wait a long time for anything to load and so on, but they had something called Dvorak, which promised to be able to offer you your news and your weather and your stocks and so on. It never worked. It was hopeless. Then they had Pointcast. That was going to be a screensaver that delivered exactly the headlines you wanted. Terrible. Personalization has overpromised and underdelivered for 15 years, but I think it's about to really happen. I don't know how many of you know Last FM. I'm sure most of you do. It's a music streaming site where you can listen if you like this kind of music. This person over here also likes this other kind of music. You know, it's the recommendation, and you may discover and find out new things. You know, where is the news equivalent of that? I mean, it seems to me that kind of, who's going to be the curator for the kind of news you're interested in is going to open the boundaries and provide some serendipity for you. I think with the semantic web, with the data-driven web, you're going to be able to get into those sorts of services quite quickly. It's taking off, tagging for web users. People are starting to get into providing their own metadata. We're starting to see services like Calais, and Twine, which offer to, if you like, put the metadata on your own content. You can go there, they will sort it, they will tag it, and then you can start to use it in all sorts of different ways. So all I'm saying is the semantic web, Web 3.0, a data-driven web, I don't pretend to understand it in detail, I'm not a technologist, but rather than people rolling their eyes, I personally think it's about to break quite hard upon us, and it's going to take us up, ramp us up to another level. So to wrap up, I just want to say two or three things and try and draw some thoughts together out of all of that. I suppose I think one of the big changes is this move from mass to community-based participation. The kind of news experience and the news cycle is atomizing. And one of the things to keep an eye on through all of that is, what do audiences want? What are they actually going to use, and what do they find useful, as opposed to what do we find really sexy to deliver? Because it may not be the same thing. How do we have a public dialogue through all of that? How do you hold a collective dialogue together? And I suppose we get very focused on the younger demographic in mainstream media, but don't forget the baby boomers in the States here. They are a third of the population are over 50, but well over 40% of time spent online is from that same demographic. I think when we look at what audiences want, sometimes we get dragged down to the younger demographic, I think, wrongly. Secondly, economics from that fragmenting model. I wonder if we need new metrics. Most newspapers, radio, television, basically try to count raw eyeballs or ears. How do we measure engagement? Because I think if we're going to try and find a new economic model, it's going to have to be around something other than raw numbers in this fragmenting environment that we're in. What can we learn from the music and gaming industries as they've, I think, gone through some of this sometime ahead of us? And I think there are real analogies there to understand what's likely to happen in journalism and in news and information. And there may well be some lessons we can draw from that. Can big media really adjust? Can we walk the walk as well as talk the talk? And I think there are some real questions about that. Tom Curley, the head of the AP, made a speech last year which I thought was terrific. He said, "The adjustment we're being asked to make is to a world of increased access, new competition, and different business models. It's not about easing into the obit page." In other words, it's about vision, it's about confidence, it's about trying to find that new sense of social purpose that I talked about, reinventing a social purpose for the media that resonates with the public. You know, there is real opportunity as we go through this transformational change, but you've got to have the confidence and the strength to set out to find it. And I suppose finally, this move from a static to a live and dynamic web, from text to video, tagging, metadata, and all the opportunities that that's going to provide for new kinds of service that we haven't even imagined yet. And it's local and it's global. It's local because it's what's personal to me, and it's global because you want to be related to all of the opportunity and everything that's out there as well. And that tension just plays out in all sorts of different ways. That's it. I hope it's given you something to think about, and I very much look forward to being part of the conversation over the next 24 hours. Thanks very much.
Richard Sandbrook, what a tour de force. I have no idea how you ever sleep. It's hard to imagine that you actually run a news organization, huge one, and also know all this. It's really remarkable. Thank you. So before we go have a glass of wine, let's at least get some further thoughts and reactions from this group formerly known as the audience and the participatory mode that we're in here. There are two mics on either side, and it'd be great if a few people would mind giving initial reactions. We've got Richard on the hook up here, but comments on Dean Wilson's comment and so forth would also be most welcome. Ethan, will you do you mind coming to a mic, or can we get you a mic? How about we'll bring one to you?
No, it's okay. I'll step back and blog.
You're also very loud, which is good.
That's good.
But it's recorded. So.
So Richard, thank you. That was really helpful and actually quite provocative. And one of the things that I was interested to hear about in your talk was almost the sense of frustration that it sounds like you've had, maybe the BBC has had, with trying to figure out how to get user involvement with your content. And that Twitter story is particularly poignant. But what's interesting about this is that almost all the examples you gave were essentially inviting people into your universe. You had decided what the story was going to be and what the venue for their participation was going to be, and then you invited them to the party, and it's almost disappointment that they didn't show up to be with you. I guess one of the things that I'm very interested in is whether we believe that citizen media, participatory media, can change the news agenda, whether there are ways in which participation from citizens can sort of shape what the story is going to be, and what would that mean for an organization like BBC if the bloggers or the videocasters or someone else out there was determining what you were looking at, rather than you guys choosing what to look at and then sort of waiting for everyone to react to what you're doing.
Yeah, I completely agree with all of that, Ethan, and I think that is, again, a very kind of old media attitude. You know, we're having a party at our place and you've got to come here, and then we're going to lock the doors and we're not going to let you out, as opposed to going out to where people are gathering and going over and saying, can we buy you a drink? It's a completely different model, and we are starting to shift, and so one of the things that's happening in the BBC is we're allowing people to take our video and embed it on their sites. We've, up until now, we've said that's verboten. Now we suddenly recognise, actually, that's a real plus for us. And starting to kind of take other bits of our content and do what they want with it and repurpose it and so on. And, you know, we're getting a lot more relaxed about that. But it's taken a long time because, the, you know, the copyright lawyers and we've got to get them into our, we've got to have the eyeballs and everything onto our site, not theirs, and so on. So people are starting to understand it doesn't really work that way, and you've got to go to where people choose to have the discussion and be part of it and to seed those discussions and nurture them in different ways. So I think we are starting to understand that. I think actually we absolutely respond to the way people have kind of defined a news agenda and shifted a news agenda, and news is broken on blogs, and there's all sorts of celebrated examples. I mean, the Dan Rather thing is probably the, you know, the one of the most talked about and so on. But I suppose the difficulty is to, you know, if you were to look at the comments on the BBC site, most of them are, you know, abusive or, you know, frankly, you know, not really of great editorial value. I think even they would say that. That's not really what it's there for. But we're very happy for them to come and, you know, shout at each other and do whatever they want there. But is it really something that's moving on the news agenda and really engaging with it? No, it's not. And I suppose that there is a frustration to say, where, you know, absolutely buy into the theory that somewhere the, you know, the audience or the former audience is out there defining the news agenda. We just can't find out where they're doing it. That will happen. Network journalism, the opportunities of network journalism, the theories that we haven't found the right way of getting that to work. Yeah, I agree.
You can stay there. You can just come back for a second. You can go on the hook, which is, give some credence on it, right? To imagine not necessarily the BBC, but to any large media organization. You have something in mind behind this question. I have no doubt this is your kind of agenda. What's the agenda?
Well, sure. I mean, first of all, again, you find yourself with the same example, right? You know, when you invite people to your site to sort of comment on your coverage, you know, that's where you sort of get the abusive and the not particularly helpful. And again, really what I'm asking in this is who's out there, not necessarily doing the original reporting, but some of the other things you mentioned within the citizen journalism space, whether it's the breaking news, whether it's the original opinion thing, some different sort of perspective on all of it. You know, where I'm really going on it is sort of a fear that what happens in citizen media is that the agenda gets set by mainstream media. Bloggers have taken themselves into sort of a commentary role, sort of an error-checking role. The example that you put up there, the Dan Rather story, you know, this is our great victory as bloggers, and it was basically fact-checking that should have been accomplished by a professional journalism organization.
Yeah.
That's not changing the agenda.
Mm-hmm.
The question is whether citizen media out there can change what are the stories that happen on the BBC site over time.
Mm-hmm.
And that probably involves doing really sophisticated monitoring of what happens out there. Now, what's interesting is that BBC probably does the highest quality media monitoring out there of any organization. But you're monitoring traditional media for the most part. The reports that you put on the blog showing what's going on in Arab media are extremely incisive. They're extremely on point. But trying to figure out how you're doing that within newsrooms, within newsgroups, within blogs, within the places that people are actually choosing to air the issues they're interested in, letting that drive your coverage. That would be sort of my main insight. I'd say,
I don't disagree with you at all, Ethan. And I think we do try and do it to some extent. I mean, we use Global Voices a great deal, and you know, it's a fantastic site, and congratulations on it. I think it's brilliant. And you know, World Have Your Say lives off Global Voices probably more than it should. But you know, we have that kind of, we try and have that interactivity, and I'm sure there are examples, I can't bring one to mind at the moment, where we pick something up out, you know, that's been out there, and of course one of the things is as soon as we pick it up, it then becomes something else. But I do agree with you in principle that we need to be more open to that than we are. But there is a kind of cultural issue there as well.
Susan Burnett. Richard, I thought your talk was really, really good. And I wanted to just kind of call out something you said about the need to reconnect journalism with the sense of social purpose. I've been doing a lot of thinking in the past 3 or 4 months about what makes communities and hyperlocal sustainable. Why did Ome News work? And I think that one of the things that is very different than journalism is that you really see 2 kinds of coverage in local communities. Events that happen that people write about, and events that people create because they have a problem they need to solve or something they need to change. So whether it's the traffic light, the community garden, the bad teacher at the high school, when you get away from that very small minority of people who kind of are the civic leaders, a lot of what you see in local participation is about things that people actually need to organize around. And traditionally, journalism and organizing are 2 separate fields. So I'm really interested in that idea of how social purpose and the agendas that people in a locale have really affect what we think of as both real-time coverage of people's efforts to reflect their journey or their agenda, and that much more reflective, analytical thing that we often rely on from the press, which is saying, well, what does it mean? Or are these people trustworthy with, you know, what's valid? And I think that local is really the cauldron where we can try to figure a lot of that out. And I'm very interested in knowing if the BBC is doing anything around tools to lower the barrier of entry so that it's not so hard for people who are, you know, truly local and not bloggers or journalists to actually reflect more of their story, you know, on a local level, not just around like national political issues.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Susan. I mean, I suppose that's kind of what campaigning journalism, you know, has been. We did have something we called ICANN a few years ago, which was basically a site to try and provide people with the tools to discover what's going on and to link them up with people who were, you know, concerned about the same issue in some other part of the country, and to support each other and learn from each other's experiences and so on. So it might be an issue about hospital waiting lists or, you know, some other community issue, and we put them in touch with other communities also concerned about that and provide them with the tools to find out who they should be talking to, who they should be going to see, you know, trying to understand what the kind of civic infrastructure and the civic framework around it was and so on. It was sort of reasonably successful for a while, but we just killed it because it was kind of in the end, you know, it wasn't doing anything and it wasn't getting enough interest, and we did think at one point about, you know, can we give it away and let someone else run it, but again, I don't think there was very much interest in it. So, I mean, I think there are, you know, again, it's one of those examples, which is, I suppose, is where I come back to that reality check. I think there's a lot of that can happen. I think a lot does happen on a local level. I think trying to do it on a bigger scale, actually, it's really difficult to make it justifiable and make it work. And that's, I think, one of the conundrums we have. There's all sorts of opportunities and potential out there, but not all of it gets traction.
One of the things that I just but really struck me is when I went to visit Oh My News in 2005, they talked about how Korea was such a small country and there was no progressive media and there was pent-up demand. And I think that whole question on a national level of how do you, what topics address pent-up demand for people to have a voice is the other thing that
we did a thing on our main evening news a few years ago where we said, come and tell us what you want us to report on. And it threw up some very surprising things. It turned out there were a big issue in Britain at the time was lap dancing clubs opening up all over the country. And people were all these different local campaigns about people campaigning against it, which had been completely kind of unseen. It was below the surface. A bizarre example, maybe. But there are ways of doing it, but we haven't really found something that's got kind of sustainable traction yet.
Thank you. I'm Rasmus. I'm a PhD student in communications at the Columbia School of Journalism. I was wondering, as I heard your talk, clearly I think your talk demonstrates that you have a very deep understanding of the possibilities that are out there, and yet you keep returning to this problem that you work in what you call an old media organization that makes it really difficult to pursue some of these potentials. I was wondering if you could maybe open that black box a little bit for us and let us in on what more precisely the problems are that you encounter in BBC. Is it a problem of a dominant model of journalistic professionalism that is not that doesn't lead the young journalists to pursue that vocation because they want to moderate conversations or facilitate debate, but because they want to tell stories themselves to an audience? Is it a problem of legal understanding of what information is and who owns that and so on and so forth? Is it a problem on the management side? What are the more concretely the bureaucratic struggles that you're involved in the BBC to try to push through some of these changes?
I'm not sure it's a bureaucratic struggle. I think it's look, the BBC is a very successful organisation. You know, my part of the BBC, the international news services, get to 250 million people every week. So I haven't got a problem to solve in that sense. And actually, audiences are growing. But to try and you know, that's built on 75 years of a one-to-many model. And to say to people, actually, even though we're fantastically successful and growing, we've got to turn that on its head and start thinking in a different way, A, is a very difficult leap for people to make. You then get into all of the usual kind of, you know, big issues. We have funding, it's allocated, we have a whole set of services which are up there and working, and they've got to continue to be resourced. How do you nurture innovation in an environment like that is genuinely managerially a difficult thing. It's very difficult to have really creative innovation from within a long-standing successful model. It's got to come in from the outside, generally, in my view. And to the extent that we have had success there and have been innovative, it's generally been the kind of skunk works model that you've had something that's happened out here and we've now moved it in. So, you know, one of the things we're doing at the minute is we've just completely reorganized all of the BBC, but in the news area, we now have a multimedia newsroom, which means that we have the same editorial oversight across radio, TV and the internet for the first time. Had very successful sites before. They were all separately managed with a degree of coordination. They're now integrated, and we're trying to see how far you can push that integration in terms of people working across all of the media, and we'll see what comes out of that. But to do that organisationally in the news area, the newsroom is 3,000 people, and you've got to keep, you know, multiple 24/7 networks on air while you do all this major change. You know, it's difficult. You know, it's as simple as that. It's not that there's a kind of huge resistance to it. I think if you were to talk to anyone in the BBC, they get it, and they know they've got to change, and we know we've got to lose 3,000, you know, colleagues in a 20,000 organisation in order to be able to pay for some of the change. But actually doing it and pushing it through and getting it to work is complicated and difficult stuff. And, you know, that's what all big media organisations are facing at the moment. Some are choosing not to do it.
Richard, thank you. So we are at time, but let's take a comment each from the three people standing up, and then Richard, you can have the last word. But please remember that you're standing between 100 people and a glass of wine. So in terms of shortness.
It's okay, because my question is like a 5-minute long answer, so I'll talk
to you. Sounds great. So do you two mind making your comments?
Yeah, I'll make this extremely quick because I want that wine too. Doreen Weisenhaus, University of Hong Kong, where I'm director of the Media Law Project, and we study a lot of issues throughout Asia, in which, of course, citizen journalism has become quite a rallying force. Is part of the reason why there is this hesitancy to release control over content is this fear for liability, whether it's defamation or copyright and so on. And so there's this concern for quality. Following up with Oh My News in South Korea, they have 50,000 contributors, and what are they doing? And what they've decided to do is not just provide the technical tools, you know, here's where we can in the platform, but also the professional tools. Last November, they started a journalism school just south of Seoul, in which anyone can come. They do online courses and so forth to teach citizen journalists what are some of the basic elements of what gives you credibility, avoidance of conflicts, how to do interviews, and you know what is basic, you know, bottom line research and so forth. So to enhance the quality of whatever it is contributed, not just base it on content, but you know, you go out there and find the content, but here's some basic elements here. I mean, is that something that more traditional media would want to take more advantage of, providing those kinds of tools?
Excellent. Sir?
Mine's more of a little bit of a question. There are two things that kind of popped out to me there. This is my first kind of forum that I'm going to. My name is Dan Beckman. I'm from Currents Collective Journalism Department. And I also worked at ABC News for 4 years, where I watched the bureaus, even domestically. I don't even know if they have like two or three anymore, since I was there over the last 4 years. So there are two things that came out to me. Number one, that BBC actually has a lot of these bureaus open still, but the New York Times thing that you pointed out there, they're getting smaller. Their actual physical paper is getting smaller. And these are places that have the funds and resources to add new ingredients to the discussion that a lot of people on the internet talk about. So I'm always interested in where things originate on the one hand. And then on the other hand, is you talked about the creatives, the new creatives that have come up. What I'm constantly up against and wondering is, have we already met the needs of the original group of people that were waiting for this to happen? Those people now have a place to have their voice, and now we're having a different group of people who are used to driving through McDonald's to get their dinner or whatever it is, and they're not writing things down, they're not used to asking the questions. They may make opinions, they may take someone else's opinion and put it underneath something that may be new. I think that those two things are really incredibly interesting to me right now, because especially as an old and now going to a new place, and you're this person who's in between these two things, who brought these things together, how are we going to deliver more food to the internet, more ingredients for the discussion, more original reporting based upon citizen journalism? Is that something that you at BBC are tackling and considering in place of some of these places that you guys may be closing?
Well, I mean, I think it's a really good question, and two things about it, really. It's what I was saying about the technology. The great thing about the technology is it ought to expand that capability. You know, if you have a laptop and a camera, you can be a one-person bureau, and it's not a lot of money. And of course, we're doing a bit of that. Reuters is doing a bit of it. There are not a lot of people. ABC actually is. They're having these kind of mobile digital bureaus. People are starting to get into that now because they realise there is a new model. But it's surprised me how long it's taken to get to that, really. It seems to me that ought to be one of the huge benefits of this technology, is that you can be anywhere and you can report firsthand in an eyewitness way. For me, I didn't touch on the opinion objectivity thing, but for me, firsthand reporting is absolutely the foundation. And what worries me is when people retreat from that to opinion news, because, you know, facts are sacred, comment is free is something that I believe. So the opportunity is there, and I think it is starting to happen with the kind of mobile journalism and, you know, the use of mobile phones to film and so on. I'm surprised as well at how long it's taken, but I think it is starting to explode out there. The only other thing I'd say, I'm not sure I quite understood what you meant, was we've got to serve the kind of McDonald's drive-through audience as well, and in some ways they may be even more important to get to than the really engaged, active audience, because they're going to find what they need anyway. So there's a kind of dilemma there. That's the classic dilemma of a mass broadcaster or big circulation newspaper, as you'll know from ABC, is you can't be pushed into just serving a niche audience. And I think that's a big question for us is, you know, how do we use this to, in order to reach out into those people who are active and who may not want to choose to comment and may not want to email in their picture and their views, but actually, you know, absolutely need to be part of the public dialogue and the public debate in some way as well. Just briefly on the kind of education question, it's absolutely something that we're quite heavily involved in the BBC. We've got our own College of Journalism and, you know, very interested in kind of connecting with other initiatives in that area as well. So, you know, maybe we can catch up later tomorrow or something.
Richard Sandbrick, much food for thought. Let's thank you.
Thanks so much.